Welcome in to You're the Cure right here on AM 580 with Dr. Ben Edwards, MD, Melody Wilkes, health coach. I'm Wade Wilkes. Glad to have you out there in Radio Land as well. Check out the website, veritasmedical.com. Of course, you can go there and catch up on past archived programs, veritasmedical.com. Let me say good morning to Dr. Ben Edwards, Melody Wilkes. Good morning to both
good
of you.
Good morning.
How are things?
Really good.
This is going to be a great show,
yes,
by the way.
I'm excited.
I'm really excited. I am too. Can we say that at the same time?
I'm excited.
Oh, okay, anyway, I'm really excited, too.
What are y'all so excited about?
Well, I'm excited because I want to know about coronavirus.
We want to know. Well, you know, you hear so much through the news, and we know a lot of it is, not all of it, but some of it, maybe a little hype. So we want to know the real deal. We want truth.
Yeah, it's funny. Speaking of hype, I was just looking up some old headlines, going back to
2003 SARS.
Yeah, well, and I mean, it's like every couple of years there's some new big scare. So 2005, the headline was, it was this cataclysmic extermination events about to happen. They calculated 2 million Americans were going to succumb to the bird flu.
Oh, yeah, the bird flu.
Best case scenario calculated back then was 200,000 were going to die. That was best case.
Swine flu.
That was bird flu, 2005. And, yeah, swine flu was 2009.
H1N1.
Very similar kind of headlines for swine flu. It turns out both of those pandemics were, they overshot their estimates, grossly exaggerated, basically, those estimates. And then, of course, Ebola in 2014, that was the main headline. 2015, it was the measles in Disneyland. In 2016, it was the Zika virus was going to overtake all of us and all the babies. Multiple pertussis outbreaks sprinkled in all through here. Measles again in 2019 was a big headline, and then this coronavirus. So, usually, and I mean, I'm not making any predictions necessarily, but usually these headlines are pretty inflammatory and hyped and anxiety and fear provoking, mm-hmm. and then they turn out to not be. And I don't know with this one because the numbers seem to change. There's some question on the accuracy of the numbers. I mean, initially looking at some of the numbers coming out of China, the official numbers, you were seeing like a 15% death rate. I've seen numbers that it was only 300 deaths out of 17,000 confirmed cases. So that's like a 3% death rate. And it tends to be in the elderly where the immune system is more compromised. But then there's other reports that maybe those aren't accurate numbers, that the Chinese aren't letting out all the real numbers. So I don't know. Who knows? I know one thing, though. Stress and fear compromise the immune system significantly.
Yep.
And it's this whole, all these bugs, bird flu, swine flu, coronavirus, which coronaviruses have been around for a real long time. Apparently, this one may be a new variety or a new version of coronavirus, possibly jumped from an animal. Who knows? It's interesting, the city that this is kind of ground zero in Wuhan, China, that was China's first maximum security virology laboratory, biosecurity level 4. So basically what that means is there's a special lab set up in this city in China that was designed to study all these real dangerous pathogens from around the world. And who knows what they do in these labs, how they purposely mutate and infect, you know, different strains with different animals. I mean, who knows what's going on there, and who knows if that's where this virus came from. It's interesting, though. So that's the unpredictability part of this. If this is in any way coming out of a lab where there's potential adulteration or mutation or purposeful manipulation of a virus, and if we're a virgin population now and haven't seen it, you know, it could be more significant, but it's hard to tell, I think, at this stage, especially if we're not getting accurate numbers. So that little question mark in my mind makes it something to watch a little closer, the fact that Wuhan has this big biosecurity lab, and is there any connection there? I don't know. The other interesting thing was Johns Hopkins Center for Health and Security along with the World Economic Forum and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, they sponsored this pandemic preparedness exercise this past fall in October of 2019. This was obviously before coronavirus was the outbreak started, or probably anyone even heard of coronavirus. And they did this simulation in New York, and they predicted a death toll of 65 million people over 18 months across the world in this simulation for coronavirus.
Hmm.
I mean, who knows? I mean, that's kind of interesting, and what a coincidence that a couple months before this outbreak happens. And I'm not trying to say Bill and Melinda Gates are somehow causing it. And I'm sure even if they're in any way involved with the lab or the experimentation, because, you know, looking with the positive goggles on, you would say, because they also got a patent on this virus. I think in 2018 the patent was issued. And why would you get a patent on a virus? Well, to study it and to potentially come up with a vaccine for it and to help, you know,
waiting for the vaccine.
Save the world, basically. So it could have been all real innocent and with all good intentions that this virus was studied and looked at, and some animals were infected with it, and some you know, studies were done to simulate or predict what an outbreak would look like, and then let's get the vaccine ramped up. You know, who knows? But if that's the case, then my problem with that is we don't have a very good track record with these vaccines. As we talked about with Neil Miller a couple weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, it's a short-sighted treatment philosophy, these man-made vaccines, with unintended consequences. One estimate, if this coronavirus vaccination is put into play, they would estimate 1 out of 1,000 would die from the vaccine. And so people forget that. You know, more people die from the measles vaccine. I think the last count I saw was 462 or something like that over the past 10 years. Don't quote me on that. That was a previous show where I had the data in front of me. But multiple hundreds have died from the measles vaccine over the last decade or two compared to, you know, one or two or three that, or maybe it's more than, maybe it's 10 now that have died from actual measles. So we have to understand these vaccines don't come without risk, including death. And you have to really weigh, do we need to work on the terrain more, or do we need to work on trying to kill a virus more? And there's a balance there. And we have to be very judicious and prudent in our thinking.
The United States Army shut down the smallpox vaccination in 2006, right after I took it, of course, because they had older soldiers above the age of 50 that were taking this vaccine, and they didn't know about the unintended consequences of the vaccine. They would take the vaccine, and if they had any kind of eczema or anything in their past, it would have a wild reaction to that and cause a cardiac arrest.
Yeah.
And it was killing a few guys, and they said, is this really worth, soldiers, is this really worth us giving the soldiers this smallpox vaccination, which hadn't been issued since 72, and this was more of a cowpox kind of deal, but under the idea that Saddam Hussein had smallpox in his inventory and he was going to unleash that on, or the Republican Guard was going to unleash it on us when we went to Iraq.
Right.
And so they stopped because they said, oh, we're going to take the chance that they don't have it.
Right.
But it killed some guys before they got there.
Yeah. Well, and we've talked about polio with Dr. Tom Cowan and how when that vaccine came out, there were some deaths associated with it and just some polio. In fact, in one point in time, there's more polio cases from the vaccine than from the actual virus. So we need to give some context. You know, most people that, I mean, number one, let's talk about polio for a second, just to review that interview. And I encourage people to go back on our archive page on veritasmedical.com under resources, radio shows, Tom Cowan's interview on vaccines and autoimmunity. And he talks about it in his book, and he talked about it in the interview, how the polio virus has been a part of our normal gut flora for millennia. Something happened, something changed to shift our environment, to shift the terrain that allowed that polio virus to become virulent and become where it can cause symptoms. And in fact, there was a real question on, was it even that virus that was causing it? And a real good case is laid out in Tom Cowan's book, and then a second book that he references, Moth in an Iron Lung, that it was potentially the environmental factor was DDT and some other pesticides they were spraying, because of how the action of DDT is on the anterior horn of the ventral cord, exactly where this virus was supposedly attacking victims, causing the paralysis we call polio. It was the exact same mechanism, and a lot of the epidemiology looked like it overlaid with DDT. Another historical thing we need to consider is the measles and the other childhood illnesses where death rates used to be significant. There was a 99% drop in death rate in the early 1900s prior to the vaccine coming out. Dr. Suzanne Humphreys goes over this historical data very clearly in her book. Her book is called Dissolving Illusions. And how could there be a 99% drop in measles death rate and whooping cough and other childhood illnesses? It was clear that it was all environmental. When you cleaned up the sanitation, the drinking water, the sewer water, when you didn't mix those, when you the overcrowded conditions, fresh food, sunlight, the smog in the cities where these outbreaks were happening, once they figured out to keep sanitation better, the outbreaks went away. And this one just in the big cities in America. This was noted in England and throughout Europe. So, again, context. We've got to not base our things out of fear, our decisions out of fear and anxiety. We have to give context to all of these. And it's very clear if you really study all these different bugs, this is way more about your own immune system and your terrain. And we can talk in a minute about some natural therapies that have been shown over the years to be very antiviral, to the tune of 60 out of 60 cases of polio symptom-free in 72 hours with high-dose administration of intravenous or intramuscular vitamin C. And that's been documented in the Southern, I don't have the journal in front of me. It was, I think, 1940, 1942. I meant to grab this book before I came and forgot, but Tom Levy, his book, Primal Panacea, he documents hundreds of studies, most of which were done by Dr. Renner in North Carolina in the 1940s, about the antiviral effects of high doses of vitamin C intravenously. And I know we have a text or a caller real quick. We'll take that question. So we'll go through some of the other treatments, from iodine to sodium bicarb to silver, vitamin C, homeopathy, ozone, documented success, UV light. So lots of historical published data on the antimicrobial effects of lots of these natural things. And unfortunately, it appears in medical school that I only was taught things that were patentable, meaning pharmaceuticals. No one told me about Dr. Renner's study published in that surgery journal in the 1940s about vitamin C. And it wasn't just polio that was cured with that. The book is very clear with hundreds of studies. Measles, mumps, rubella, every virus he tried that on. We've talked to Dr. Rowan in the past. He's the head of Ozone Societies. He used to be on the Medical Board of Alaska, and he spearheaded a lot of laws in Alaska and I think in California too that allows doctors to practice complementary and alternative medicine. And he published a study in the Journal of Transcendental Medicine about Ebola and ozone and how ozone is so effective on viruses in general. But he took his ozone machine and his team to Sierra Leone, and they treated patients, and they became symptom-free in 48 hours with direct IV ozone administration, because the ozone basically chops off the finger-like projections on the outer capsule of the virus. These finger-like projections on the virus is what allows the virus to get into a cell, to attach to a human cell, open up our human cell membrane, and come in. The virus has to get inside our cell to be able to replicate itself. So if you can prevent a virus from getting in your cell, then it can't replicate. And ozone chops off those little finger-like projections. They're sulfhydryl groups is the scientific name. and ozone oxidizes those and destroys them. So that virus cannot enter the cell anymore. And ozone's been used for 100 years in Germany. Lots of literature, stacks, mountains of research papers published. And again, Dr. Rowan was pretty clear on his interview on the success he had with ozone. But ozone's oxygen, it's O3. It's a naturally occurring substance. Again, not patentable. So it's very, very interesting, and we really should be putting all of Bill Gates's very generously donated philanthropic efforts and money into more research to see if we can replicate Dr. Rowan's ozone study and see if we could replicate Dr. Renner's vitamin C studies now in 2020 that Dr. Renner was doing in the 1940s. Is it still feasible today? There's other studies we'll go through later on sodium bicarbonate iodine. We should be putting all our money and efforts into these therapies because the side effects of these therapies are basically beneficial. That's the beauty of the and there's herbs we'll talk about in a minute too. One particular extract from red algae that prevents these virus from replicating in us, the coronavirus in particular. But there's no money in any of that. I mean, Bill Gates could donate his money if he felt like it because he has plenty. But your average Joe Smo and your average company and your pharmaceutical company is not going to do that. Why would you spend hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars researching this stuff and publish a study that says red algae prevents coronavirus from replicating? Because you can't.
There would be money in it, though.
There would be some money, but not the big money, not the gazillions and billions that are in vaccines and pharmaceuticals. Because you can't put a patent on red algae, so there'd be lots of competition. So you have lots of people selling red algae, and you make some money. I mean, there obviously people sell supplements and herbs and natural things, and there's some money in it, but it's not the big, big money. Mm-hmm. But my point is, we've got 100 years worth of natural therapies that have been, there's published data on, and we should be looking at that much more aggressively, because in the pharmaceutical world, there's not really an option. I mean, Tamiflu's a joke. A lot of these countries are actually suing the Tamiflu manufacturer, or have in the past sued them for false data. There's publication bias that we've talked about before on the show. So half of Tamiflu's studies showed no benefit, and they just didn't publish it. They were finally able to tweak some statistics to make it show some benefit without much harm or risk. And they would publish that study, and the benefit it showed was a decrease of symptoms by 1 hour or 1 day out of 14 days. Very, very minimal benefit. And again, that's not publishing all the studies that showed negative outcomes or no benefit. So, I mean, Tamiflu and the other antivirals are very, very ineffective. So, we're kind of wasting our time, money, and if you're putting any hope in that, I sure wouldn't. But there's lots of hope in these natural therapies. So,
okay, to the text line we go. First one says, a proper comparison isn't between number of people who died from the measles vaccine versus number who died from measles today. It's the number or percent who died from measles then versus how many who die from measles vaccine today.
Wait, say, I'm not following
that. No, that's
that.
Kind of a tough one. Proper comparison isn't between the number of people who died from the measles vaccine versus the number who died from measles today. It's the number or percent who died from measles then versus how many who die from the measles vaccine today.
Okay. Yeah, I don't have those numbers in front of me. What I can say is there was a 99% reduction of death rate before the measles vaccine, but I don't have the exact hard
it's
numbers.
It's essentially an opportunity cost calculation. That's what it says. Essentially, opportunity cost calculation.
Okay, I don't have those numbers. I'll give you my opinion and my bias. And my bias is God created our immune system to do exactly what man's attempt with these artificial immunity-inducing vaccines. So I'll give you the how it used to be. So the measles was an innocuous virus that did very little more than a cold. Everyone got all my old patients that come in, because we take a very thorough 2-hour history. We go all the way back to how healthy was your mom when you were born, and then we go through the childhood illnesses. And everyone who's, you know, over 60 or 70 years old, just they tell me, yep, had the routine childhood illnesses. Had a patient last week tell me this. And they say it just like I would tell a doctor who was asking me about my childhood. Yep, I had chicken pox. It was no big deal. It was a little fever. It was a little itchy. I was out of school for a week. And that's how it was for everybody. No one panicked. No one worried about it. It was not a big deal. It's an innocuous childhood illness. So that's how measles used to be. Everybody got it. The Brady Bunch episode, the famous episode of if you want to be sick, measles is a way to do it. And you get to skip school and have mom make you chicken soup. I mean, that's the kind of mentality. It was not a big deal. And you got it when you were 6, 7, 8 years old. And that innocuous childhood illness that didn't really cause any harm, hardly, percentage-wise, super low percent of anyone that had any anything beyond just basically a cold. But those kids had the benefit of lifetime immunity from 8 years on for the rest of their life, including right now. That 72-year-old I saw last week, he's still totally immune to measles today. Because when you are infected with the measles naturally, it infers an immunity that's lifelong. And when I say naturally, I mean when you breathe it in through your nose, through your mouth, or swallow it into your GI tract, there's certain immune system cells that line your nose, sinuses, and airway, and your trachea, and your lungs, your air sacs in your lungs, and that line your gut. Those immune system cells have a certain intelligence to them. This intelligence allows them to build antibodies that are lifelong. You bypass that. Those immune system cells get bypassed when you inject something straight into the muscle. And it's a different type of immunity that's not fully long-lasting. That's why you see these outbreaks with people who were vaccinated. I mean, pertussis, it's mostly always vaccinated kids within the outbreaks. So it's a totally different immunity. But back to that scenario. So you get this natural virus when you're 7 years old. You're out of school for a week with a cold and a fever. You have lifelong immunity now. When you're 20 years old and you get pregnant and you have this baby, you've passed your lifelong antibodies onto that baby through the placenta and through the breast milk. So that baby's totally protected of measles, just like the mom is for the rest of her life. That baby's protected that first year, second year, third year. When the baby's immune system is immature and not ready to handle a measles outbreak, and he doesn't have to worry about it. He's fully immunized by his mom's breast milk. Those breast antibodies will stay in that baby for about 6 or 7 years, and then they wear off. They go away. And so the kid's 7 years old, 8 years old, and measles comes through the community, and he gets it, and it's an innocuous childhood illness, and he has a little fever for a week, and now he's good to go for the rest of his life. That's God's way. That's God's natural design. And it turns out, as Neil Miller talks in his book and shows multiple published studies, and we didn't really get to this in his show, so I'll try to bring it up maybe when I have another open show. Studies have shown a natural measles infection infers benefit, 20, 30, 50 years down the road as far as cancer and cardiovascular disease. There's something about the training of the immune system by the measles virus naturally that gives you this extra leg up against cancer and against heart disease. So it's fascinating and incredible the way our immune system's designed. Now, as we talked about with Neil Miller, we're producing another virgin population. Like the guy last week in my clinic that was 70 years old and had natural measles and natural immunity for his life. Those guys and gals will be dying off over the next 10 and 20 years. And so pretty soon our population is going to be full of people who only had the vaccine version of measles and not the wild-type native immunity. So the measles wild-type outbreaks are going to occur more and more and more is the prediction by not just me, but a number of other colleagues that look at things from a more natural standpoint. And it just makes sense because we don't have that lifelong immunity. The measles shot doesn't give you that. Or quality immunity. The immune system's not trained up as well. So, again, I know this is a hot topic, and I know people who had polio, even in my family, my wife's family, and I know it's very controversial and debatable, and it just pains me that the truth isn't out there more, especially when it came to polio, when Renner's publishing stuff in the 1940s, before the vaccine came out for polio, and it once I think it was 72 out of 72. It's either 60 out of 60 or 72 out of 72 cases, and I'll try to remember to bring a book next time we talk about this. But people can go look it up themselves. Dr. Renner, he was in North Carolina, and this was a Southern Journal of Surgery, I think June of 42. But Primal Panacea is the name of the book where Tom Levy summarizes not only Renner's work, but lots of other doctors' work. Back to coronavirus.
Yeah, I have a question on that. That was the next text. It says, Jennifer said, I'm a big believer in MMS. I think it could kill the coronavirus if people were given that as an option. It knocked out the flu for both my husband and daughter after only taking it for a day. They were much better and fever-free the following day. It also has many household disinfecting and odor removal uses.
Right. MMS, Miracle Mineral Supplement, Jim Humble, H-U-M-B-L-E. So I've had a number of patients bring this to me over the years, and I've read through Jim Humble's stuff and have to be careful. It's not FDA recommended or Texas Medical Board recommended. So I know that some sanctions have been levied against doctors who are promoting that because of the lack of FDA approval. I do know that this MMS, which is, I believe it's sodium chloride. Anyways, it's approved for disinfecting, for swimming pool cleaning, for other water purification, basically. And that's where Jim, I'll just tell you his story, his testimony is, and what's in his book. He was working for a mining company in South America, I believe. And he was way out, you know, far away from civilization, exploring the jungles for whatever he was looking for. And him and his partners and some of the guys on his team got malaria. And they didn't have medicine for malaria. And these guys were getting sicker by the minute. They couldn't get to a doctor. They were too far away. All they had were these water purification tablets. So they started basically just taking a bunch of those and drinking a bunch of that water, and they got remarkably better within like 24 hours or some short period of time that you don't normally get over malaria that quickly. So Jim came home and started to study what exactly was this water purification tablet. That study led him to more study and more study, and basically to come up with this version that he gave to people. Mostly in third world countries, he'd go to Africa. He went, I think, to Cuba and some other places where there was a lot of malaria, where there was other diseases. According to Jim, even had a Red Cross involved in a study in Africa and showed very good outcomes. This isn't published in a medical journal. It's not peer-reviewed, and it's not FDA approved. And so, you know, those are the facts people can, as I know them, or as he reports them in his book. So people need to go do their own research on that. I just have to be careful about what I say. You know, I'm happy to talk about stuff that's well within the bounds of medical board approved. These studies that are published in peer-reviewed journals, which, you know, again, we have to be careful there, because what gets published, as I mentioned with Tamiflu, there's a thing called publication bias. I mean, the reason Dr. Round had to go publish his ozone article in some, you know, random journal that most doctors have never heard of, the Journal of Transcendental Medicine, is other journals just wouldn't take it. They weren't going to accept it. So we have to understand there are lots of different biases and lots of different points of view and interest, people with different motives and interest involved in the
Have you heard anybody, though, that has been taking the MMS that had any kind of contraindication or side effects or death or anything wild happened, or do you know?
I've not heard of that. And I've had some patients on their own, again, that have come to me and said, hey, I took this. And one patient in particular stands out. He had an infection in his knee, actually chlamydia in his knee, which chlamydia people think about as STD, which it is, but you can get chlamydia, pneumonia. There's different versions of chlamydia, just like there are different strains and varieties, like there is with coronavirus and influenza virus. Anyways, this guy had a septic knee. He had this bacteria was in his knee, and he had done IV antibiotics. He'd done injections into the knee. He was about to go into surgery. I mean, he was in bad shape. And he, according to him, what when he started to have a turnaround, no more fever, no more redness, no more swelling, and his white count went to normals after he started taking the MMS. So very curious case. One, you know, that's one case, one patient of mine, and I've had others report similar things like that. And that's kind of the beauty of being in a more natural medicine realm is you tend to attract patients who have either failed conventional therapy, had a side effect to conventional therapy, can't get conventional therapy for whatever reason, it's contraindicated, or they're allergic to it. You know, a lot of our patients are allergic to every antibiotic or have failed a lot of antibiotics, and they have to go explore these herbal options and essential oil options and other complementary options that, again, like say in China and Japan, they've been used for a long time. You know, this isn't having to do with antibiotics or viruses, but acupuncture. Mm-hmm. You know, people would have totally laughed, or maybe most people still would if they haven't read these reports, that you could use acupuncture to treat an acute asthma exacerbation, that you don't have to do an albuterol inhaler in the emergency room. That's what the doctors in China were doing when one of my mentors was studying over there. In a gallbladder surgery, he saw anesthesia. Acupuncture uses anesthesia for a surgery. It was Ralston was a reporter for, I believe it was Washington Post or New York Times in the 1970s when Nixon traveled to China, and Ralston got acute appendicitis while he was over there, and so he had surgery to take out his appendix, and they used acupuncture on him. So very, and that was kind of the first time that the Western world's eyes were open to this use of acupuncture. Now, I'm saying that because acupuncture has been known for a long time, 1,000 years or more in China. They've been using it forever. They use it for many medical, even emergencies like an asthma exacerbation, where a United States doctor and medical board and FDA would look at that and laugh at you and or maybe reprimand you if you recommend it because it's not standard of care. So people just need to understand the Western way of doing medicine and the standard of care and the law and the medical school curriculum, and all this is, it's narrow. It's a certain philosophy. It's a pharmaceutical-based philosophy. So there are things outside of that narrow philosophy that could be beneficial, but that your doctor doesn't know about, one trained in, one taught, and possibly not even legal. I guess I'll leave it at that. My attorney would tell me to be careful where I'm treading on thin ice. But, I would just say people can feel free to explore the literature, that's the international literature even, because there's some very interesting things internationally. I used to think that, you know, America's number one. We're the best. We're always going to have the best and latest, greatest, and rely on our U.S., government and health institutions to steer us the right way and give us the best treatments and best results. And now we know clearly, very clearly, over the past 70 years, the recommendations and the treatment protocols have not produced the best results. They've produced awful results, horrible results, especially when it comes to chronic disease. And just one last thing before the break on the vaccine thing. Again, you got to look at risk and benefit. Cost analysis, I think the texter mentioned on the measles thing. And that brings to mind what we talked about with Neil Miller. The cost analysis on, that's the whole reason they did the chickenpox vaccine. I mean, chickenpox is no big deal. Doesn't kill anybody. We all get it or used to. And they admitted that when they came out with the vaccine. This is really not a big deal. But there's a cost involved. Parents have to take off work for a week. So there's an economic cost. So we need to do this vaccine because of that. So it was approved for that. Unfortunately, again, man's short-sightedness and hijacking God's original intent. This vaccine was administered and it created a shingles epidemic. We see more shingles now in younger and younger ages, and it's correlated directly with the chickenpox vaccination coming out. And the leading theory, and I think makes the most sense, is people are getting shingles because they're not being exposed to chickenpox every year anymore. Their kids, their grandkids, their Sunday school, for people in the community, school kids that they ran into around the community, that was a natural booster you got every single year. Your immune system got to see chickenpox in the community, and it kept your immune system boosted and kept it primed to keep that chickenpox virus in check, because shingles is just a reactivation of chickenpox virus. The chickenpox virus is in you forever till you die, but it is kept in hibernation basically by your immune system. And your immune system's kept primed and able to keep that in hibernation because of the way you're exposed every year to chickenpox when it came through the community. And now we're not exposed, so you don't get the natural booster. And the shingles emerges more readily, and we're seeing it more and more. And the cost of a shingles outbreak in an adult is way more costly than the chickenpox. So there's a cost analysis for you. When we get back, we may talk about the autoimmune diseases that come from the adjuvants that are in the vaccines too. Again, trying to bring informed consent, weigh all the risk and benefit. And is this the most beneficial way to go? And then you have to be at peace with it and go that way. It's all about informed consent, making a decision that's best for you and your family. So we'll talk more about that, more about coronavirus and vitamin D when we get back, because that's one of the ways we can battle these viruses, but not just your over-the-counter supplemental vitamin D. So stick with us. We will be right back. This is Ben Edwards with You're the Cure, VeritasMedical.com.
Welcome back into You're the Cure right here on AM 580. Brought to you by Veritas Medical. Check out the website, VeritasMedical.com. That's VeritasMedical, all one word, .com. Past archived programs, you can certainly check it out for sure. We'll go to the text line. If you have a text along the way, feel free to do that. You can always text in at 806-745-5800. Okay, so this texter says you can find doctors who use cold laser therapy in place of needles for acupuncture.
Yeah, I've heard of that, and acupuncture's awesome. I recommend it for lots of things, and the Western world now does obviously recognize it.
I've had it before.
Yeah, it works great. There's some kind of new age PET scan or MRI, I forget, Dr. Jerry Tennant has it in his book, where they actually documented these acupuncture pathways. They could finally see them and document it with a scan, so now we believe it. I mean, the Chinese have known about it for 1,000 years, but until we can take a picture of it with some cool camera, we're not going to believe it. But now we do believe it, and it is reimbursable by most insurances, and I don't know about Medicare, but I think so.
All right. Another text says, I'm curious if you have advice for someone who has a very holistic view of health and ascribes to alternative treatments but is considering going to medical school. My major concern is residency, and how would I need to practice Western medicine standard of care?
I get this question a lot because we have a lot of medical students and college students that come shadow, a lot of nurse practitioners that come shadow and want to do what we do or do a different way of medicine. And it's kind of a little side note. The crazy thing is the number one reason lately that nurse practs have been calling and wanting to come shadow is because of the stress and the burden of just the way that system is. Not necessarily conventional pharmaceutical versus natural. It's just the system is making them see so many patients in such a short amount of time over so many hours. They got to work longer days, cram more into a day, see more patients, more paperwork, less reimbursement, just stress, and just the way the system's actually functioning, much less the poor outcomes we get. But anyways, back to this question. It really depends. So I had one pre-med student from Tech come shadow. She was like top of her class and was already accepted into med school, took a year off to get married, came and shadowed at our clinic, and her eyes were opened to getting to the root cause of disease and helping people address root causes and all the epigenetic factors that turn on the genes that cause disease. And she was fired up and tore up her acceptance letter and applied to a naturopathic medical school. So that's number one. Consider a doctorate of naturopathy. Now, he may not know what that is because state of Texas and 42 other states don't even recognize the doctorate of naturopathic medicine. But eight states, I believe, the last time I looked, it was eight, do believe in it. They accept it. They license these doctors, California, Arizona, I think Oregon and Seattle maybe. But so consider that. It's a true medical school. It's 4 years of school. Then you do residency and everything, just like you do in conventional medicine.
Is it hard to get into as medical schools? Yes,
it's difficult to get into. She was able to get into it because she was top of her class and super smart and had good recommend, just a great person. Mm-hmm. And she did great in Bastyr University Medical School. I think she was top of her class there. All her professors loved her. I think they wanted her to stay on to be a faculty and stuff.
Wow.
But she, I think, opened her own practice. But my point is, there is a different medical school option, and you could highly consider that. Just know you'll be limited to practicing just in those states. Another option, though, if you feel like you need to stay here in Texas or be recognized as an MD or a DO, just go to medical school and learn that type of medicine to know basically what not to do. In part, it's a great contrast, because what you'll see is chronic disease management and horrible outcomes. You'll see a whole floor at the hospital of people waiting for amputations because their diabetes was managed, poorly managed. But even when it's not poorly managed, you still get these bad outcomes as opposed to reverse diabetes. So, I mean, you'll get a super good taste of what not to do or the way to get bad outcomes with chronic disease management. Now, what you'll excel in is acute care, as far as like emergencies and trauma and orthopedics and broken bones and car wrecks. I mean, we have the best healthcare when it comes to that, obviously. I mean, we're awesome at that, and we need to be awesome at that, and that's the time you should need a doctor, when you have an accident or, an emergency. That's when we need them. Otherwise, the body's designed to keep blood sugar normal by itself and keep blood pressure normal by itself and birth babies naturally. We've had midwives or a midwife on before talking about the outcomes that midwives get are so much better than conventional. I mean, home births, the outcomes are so much better than hospital birth outcomes, because these are natural things. The body knows what to do and how to do it if you steward it right and keep the epigenetics right, keep your diet and lifestyle right. It's going to be a tough road if you're really holistically minded, because residency is going to be nothing but protocols with pharmaceuticals and surgery. However, you'll come out of that with your initials, your MD, and that will give you a certain amount of clout. It'll give you a certain amount of recognition. You can go to, like I'm doing, on a radio show, or you can go give a lecture somewhere, or you get invited to speak somewhere just because you have an MD behind your name. They're going to listen to you, and you may be able to impact more lives. I'm almost positive I'm able to impact more lives just because I have those initials, even though what I learned in med school and residency, I'm not applying in my practice really now, because I don't need to. When we apply non-medical training, which is diet and lifestyle training, to our patients, then their symptoms go away and they don't need. I can always resort to, as a last resort, what I learned in medical school. Metformin and lisinopril and methotrexate for your rheumatoid arthritis and all that stuff. You know, the third leading cause of death by some estimates, or the first leading cause of death, which is modern medicine and pharmaceuticals. I can resort to that if need be as a worst case scenario, but we don't usually have to now. But if you go to school, you at least have that tool in your toolbox, even if you don't want to use it or won't need to use it. But mostly you'll have a lot more clout and you'll be able to impact more lives. I've had chiropractors come up to me after a talk I give and say, "Docs, thank you so much for speaking the truth and to this audience. I've been saying the same thing for 20 years and they won't listen to me just because I'm a chiropractor." I mean, there's that thing about, you know, those initials, and it's just the way our world is right now, unfortunately, especially in some parts of the country, and we're in one of those parts, I think. So anyways, long answer. If you feel led and feel like God's leading you to med school like he did me, go, and he'll sustain you through it, and it'll be okay. And just realize that 90% or more probably of the U.S. population is not going to change their diet and lifestyle. So, I mean, what do you do with those people? You just let them suffer with their diabetes, or do you give them a drug? I mean, that's debatable, I guess, because the drug's side effects sometimes are worse than the disease. But, you know, that's what I would say is, for people that aren't going to address their diet and lifestyle, you could probably ease some suffering and help them out a little bit with some of the conventional medicine that you're going to learn in med school. So I would consider that. Back to coronavirus, I want to encourage people, greenmedinfo.com, that's Sayer G. I'm trying to get him on the show. He just wrote a book and trying to get him on to promote that book. But Sayer G, he's not a doctor. He is a connoisseur of the medical literature. So his website houses, I think, 100,000 different articles, over 10,000 different health topics. And most of them, it's the evidence-based literature out there on natural therapies. So that's where I'm getting this. I'm reading from his website, greenmedinfo.com. And there's this red algae extract that they studied on coronavirus, on SARS and MERS, the Middle Eastern virus. It was red algae griffsin. That's griffithsin. Has proven antiviral activity against HIV-1, HSV-2, that's herpes simplex virus 2, HCV, that's hepatitis C, Ebola, and corona. And what all these viruses have in common is this glycoprotein shell and the griffsin, which is the extract from red algae, inhibits the viral replication because it binds to the algae's got this mannose binding lectin is the name of the actual molecule in the red algae. This lectin binds onto the glycoprotein covering the viral envelope, and it's been shown to penetrate and break down that shell, so the virus basically implodes and it can't replicate. And it's been shown in the lab on some coronaviruses to do the same thing. So that's a pretty cool thing. This research out of a 2016 study out of University of Louisville Medical School. And then there's another study. It was out of the UK. A 2008 study out of UK Lutton and Dunstable Hospital. And then there was another one in Germany. But just look up on greenmedinfo.com, type in herbal medicines for coronavirus. Another cool website, Dr. Circus. He's a oriental medicine doctor. And Dr. Circus has written a book on magnesium, is kind of what he's famous for. Dr. Circus, that's with an S, S-I-R-C-U-S, drcircus.com. And you can type in coronavirus natural treatments, and he goes through some studies that look at vitamin A. You know, anything that will impede that virus from getting into your cell will be beneficial. And vitamin A basically puts a protective coating on your cell membrane and prevents the virus from getting in your cell so it can't replicate. But he goes through the vitamin A doses, iodine. You know, iodine's so cool because it's a natural antiseptic, and every doctor knows this who's scrubbed in on a surgery. Before you cut open a mama's womb for a C-section or the belly for an appendectomy or a cholecystectomy for your gallbladder, you're going to scrub that patient down with iodine. I mean, everyone knows that. Why? Because it kills every bug, every bacteria, virus, parasite, you name it. Iodine's awesome. Well, iodine happens to be in a family of elements called halogens, chlorine and bromide and fluoride and iodine. They're all related basically. But iodine is the halogen for the human body. It's the one God designed for our human body to have internally, not just scrubbed on your skin when you're about to have surgery. We're supposed to ingest this, and we have iodine receptors all throughout the body. Iodine's a key mineral for your thyroid to function normally, but it's also a key part of the immune system. And it's antimicrobial. It works great for all kinds of stuff. Dr. Gabriel Cousins in Dr. Circus's article here is quoted as saying iodine has been used against syphilis and chronic lung disease and skin lesions. Really anything that's microbial based, you can consider iodine. So there's different protocols on how much to take. The recommended daily allowance by the on the food labels that you'll see, that's just a very minimum dose to prevent goiter, the thyroid condition from low iodine. When you're actually going to try to treat infection, you need much higher doses. Dr. Brownstein has written a book on this, anywhere from 12.5 to 500 milligrams, and he even quotes some old recommendations from the 1910, 1911 Encyclopedia Britannica with a quote-unquote usual dose of 300,000 micrograms. Now, I'm not saying that. I'm saying in 1910, that's what the doctors were using. And I've read old medical books and journals where they talked about when they didn't know what was wrong with the patient, just get them some vitamin I for iodine. Because iodine kind of was a cure-all back in the day, in the early 1900s, before they had antibiotics. Here's another article, 1905, June 1st, 1905, New York Times. The successful use of iodine for consumption, which was tuberculosis, because it killed that pathogen. Also, within 90 seconds, it talks about it killing that pathogen and really all pathogens.
Have you heard about the mushroom that feeds on radiation?
No, I've not.
Yeah, that Wade may be able to tell you,
more. You mean makes it grow? Radiation causes it to grow more?
No, it was out of Chernobyl. And it's a big story. It happened last week. All these researchers were in there going, oh, man, this fungus is eating away at all this wildly contaminated radiological.
It's called stuff. Cryptococcus neoformans.
How crazy is that, huh?
That is crazy. I wonder if radiation. It's full of iodine.
It says that the fungi contains high levels of melanin, a pigment that turns skin darker. It absorbs radiation and turns it into chemical energy, similar to how plants turn carbon dioxide and chlorophyll into oxygen.
Wow.
And awesome. Glucose through photosynthesis.
The things in nature are incredible, mm-hmm. and the way that certain things can be transformed into other things, it's fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we really need to look to nature, like those mushrooms, for really all of our solutions.
Well, pharmaceuticals, let's be honest, they all came from a plant originally.
They mm-hmm. they send their chemists or their explorers down to the jungle, and they pick every root and bark and flower and leaf and all these, and they bring them back to the lab, and they do a spectrograph on them, and they'll pick out one or two of the most prominent chemicals, and then they'll study them in the lab, and they'll make a chemical man-made version of it. But yeah, they're all started with researching what's in nature and what's in plants. Real quick on vitamin D, I know we're running out of time, because people will see vitamin D recommendations, including on Dr. Circus's website. Dr. Brownstein has recommendations, Dr. Mercola. Here's my take on D. It may have some benefit. Taking supplemental D may have some temporary benefit, just as ascorbic acid. I mentioned vitamin C cured 60 out of 60 cases of polio and every other virus they tested against with high doses of vitamin C, and that was ascorbic acid. Short-term usage of a synthetic form, ascorbic acid or vitamin D, could have some benefit, just like Tylenol. We know Tylenol is going to bring your fever down and reduce your pain. It can have short-term benefit, but like we've talked about, pre-medicating these kids with Tylenol before a vaccine increases their risk of autism. That's published data, because it knocks out glutathione. Glutathione is your main antioxidant enzyme, and you need the antioxidant enzyme to battle the oxidative stress that the vaccine brings in. All the adjuvants, which are the chemicals they have to put into the vaccine to elicit the immune response, because if they just put a sterile water and a little bit of virus and gave you a shot, that's not a strong enough. It will not elicit a strong enough immune response. So they put in all these other chemicals like aluminum and mercury and 30 other things. These are called adjuvants. The adjuvants stimulate the immune system. But then you can also get an autoimmune-induced state, autoimmunity induced by these adjuvants. It's a new syndrome they've coined, Asia syndrome. Autoimmunity syndrome induced by adjuvants, Asia syndrome. Over a million different patients now suffering from autoimmunity from these adjuvants in the shot. But back to where I was going. Tylenol knocks out the glutathione, so then you're more susceptible to these adjuvants. You're more susceptible to vaccine damage. So, yes, Tylenol works. We know it works. It's not a matter of does this stuff work or not. It's what are the unintended consequences? We get a short-term gain for what? Question mark. That's the big question. For what long-term consequence? And we don't fully understand that. Same with D3 and same with vitamin C. We know if you take supplemental D3 every single day, you're going to diminish your ferrooxidase. That's the pocket knife, the Swiss Army knife that we talk about all the time. This Swiss Army knife called ferrooxidase is the most important antioxidant in your entire body. You do not want to compromise that Swiss Army knife. And every day administering synthetic vitamin D is going to do that, as will synthetic vitamin C every single day. Now, if you only did vitamin C for 1 or 2 days or vitamin D for 1 or 2 days synthetically, and you get some antiviral impact from that and it helps you get over the hump.
What about the vitamin C IVs?
That's ascorbic acid, yeah. So I just want to put that out there. I've seen the vitamin C, and of course, Dr. Levy's book talks about it. Dr. Renner documented it well. It works for the acute in the acute setting. So I'm not necessarily opposed to it, although I know Morley Robbins is, and I know why he is, and definitely a daily administration of it, I'd be totally against it. Because it's going to compromise your terrain and make you more susceptible to viruses. And sorry, I'm trying to get a lot in it here at the end. That it reminds me, these flu shots, they will make you more susceptible. If you get a flu shot every year, it makes you actually more susceptible to the coronavirus. There's studies that have been shown these influenza vaccines, people who get them are more likely to get non-influenza viruses that year and in the years to come. So again, unintended consequences. Be informed. Know all the potential consequences. And when you take synthetic D, you're going to increase your potassium urine output. It's called renal potassium wasting. You don't want to excrete extra potassium because potassium is a vital mineral for the body, but it's especially vital for your parasympathetic nervous system. That's your anti-stress nervous system. When you give synthetic vitamin D, it shuts down ATP production, and it kills retinol formation in your liver. Well, retinol is needed for every function of that Swiss Army knife, that pocket knife that's your number one antioxidant and so much more than that. It needs retinol, and synthetic D every single day is going to shut it down. Those are just some of the reasons, and we'll maybe have to do a whole other show on synthetic vitamin D and your vitamin D levels, because it appears that a normal vitamin D level is somewhere between 12 and 30, not 50 and 70 and 80. So these crazy low vitamin Ds are a consequence of inflammation. They're not the cause of the inflammation, so be very careful with supplemental D. Okay, I think we're out of time, but here's the bottom line. Don't let fear drive you. Work on your terrain. It's clear all these outbreaks throughout the years, going all the way back to measles, it was all about the terrain. It's all about your environment. It's all about your nutrition, hydration, movement, and peace. Fill your body up with iodine, sunshine, clean water, all the minerals. Magnesium, we didn't even talk about the antiviral effects of magnesium. Continue doing what you know is the right thing to do. Fill yourself with these minerals and with peace and with nutrition, and get vitamin D naturally through the sun and cod liver oil, and don't worry about it. You'll be fine. If you do get a little virus, it's okay. It's actually training your immune system up. These fevers are beneficial, as Dr. Tom Cowan so eloquently explained in his book. So do not fear. You're going to be okay. Be at peace. Load up on your minerals. Keep listening to the show.
Breathe.
And go look up ozone and high-dose vitamin C and UV light and the historical uses of that, along with sodium bicarb. Baking soda on the box, the baking soda box in the 1920s, it told you the dose to take for the influenza, the 1918 influenza that killed however many.
Baking soda?
It was on the box, and the doctor said the people that are taking this baking soda, I think it's a half teaspoon six times a day, they didn't get the flu. Or if they got it, it was very short-lived.
You got to be careful you don't get the kind with aluminum in it.
Yeah, get the aluminum-free. But anyways, do your research. Do your looking. It's out there. The published studies are out there. Be the cure. You're the cure. Take responsibility for your own health.
All right.
Be a partner with your doctor.
Dr. Ben Edwards, MD, Veritas Medical. Check out the website, veritasmedical.com. Have a great week, sir. We'll see you back here next Monday on You're the Cure.